Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
And it's interesting that roughly 2 out of 3 projects fail on some significant point. You know, whether that failure is an outright failure, they pull the plug on it, or a failure in terms of not going over budget or over schedule.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing fine. Well, a little bit frustrated because in my dear country of Costa Rica, we have now 3 weeks of having the tax system down because it was hacked, and they don't have a clue how to get out of it. It's so fascinating. 3 weeks, and all the business people is just losing money by millions, and I am just. I mean, it's software. I know it's complicated, but
right,
3 weeks.
Right. that's crazy. I mean, what an impact on obviously the country, on, you know, tax collection, which the country needs presumably, and also, I mean, just the hassle that causes for a business owners there, and because they're still going to have to pay them eventually, I assume, right? They're probably not getting a tax holiday out of this.
Exactly, and I think that relates to the episode that we just had, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk today with Professor Ryan Nelson from the University of Virginia about IT project management and infamous failures. And you have already highlighted a infamous failure happening right now in Costa Rica. What's something you want our listeners to look out for in this episode today?
Well, in general, it's very hard to find an academic that is connected with the reality. I mean, I always complain that I, at least in my country, I don't find an academic that is not 10 years behind of reality.
It's, right.
It's just frustrating. And I enjoyed very much that, because when you find an academic that is connected with the current reality, then you see someone that is trying to look all the situation from a very high perspective and try to make sense of things and trying to predict the future and trying to come up with things and trying to collaborate and to really give new knowledge to the market, to the industry. Yes. So I felt that with Professor Nelson, it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
Regarding that, his perspective from being a professor that is really concerned about projects and products, value delivery. And the other thing I was impressed, I have to admit, is his insights about scaling. He had many things to say about scaling. So I recommend you guys to stay to the end, because he said that at the end of the episode, actually. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And yeah, I've learned a lot of great practical advice from him. And that is always very encouraging in an academic setting, for sure. I agree. And I'll just call out to our listeners to look out for the conversation around the importance of understanding the strategy and goals of your project. That came up a couple of times, because it really determines on whether or not your project is going to be considered an infamous failure, or if you're going to repeat some of those classic mistakes. To avoid those, you really need to understand, why are we even doing this? And we talk a little bit about that with Ryan as well. So, all right, without further ado, let's get to our interview with Professor Ryan Nelson. Professor Ryan Nelson teaches in the undergraduate, graduate, and executive education programs at the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce, where he's been a recipient of the All-University Teaching Award. I can vouch for his expertise personally, since he was one of my professors in the MS and Management of IT program at McIntyre. currently serves as the director of the Center for the Management of Information Technology, a position he's held since the founding of the CMIT in 1991. Professor Nelson has published articles and cases on project management, product management, IT adoption in a variety of academic and professional journals, including the MIS Quarterly Executive, the Communications of the ACM, and the Journal of Management Information Systems, just to name a few. He's also served as a consultant to a number of large corporations, including Bank of America, the Texas Air Corporation, CFA Institute, among many others. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Ryan.
Thanks, Aaron and David. It's great to be here with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. We've known each other for a long time, and you've definitely been a big influence on my career, and as has the whole program at McIntyre. So really happy to have you here today. And we'll be talking today about IT project management, your area of expertise and research, and particularly a series of topics I know they're very important for you and that you have taught many, many students about, including myself over the years: infamous failures, classic mistakes, and best practices. And there's a lot of ground to cover there. There's a lot of infamous failures. maybe we can start a little bit with you kind of telling us a little bit about what is like the definition of a project from your perspective, and what's kind of the what makes this such an important topic.
Sure. The basic mission of a project is evolved over thousands of years, but fundamentally it's always been a temporary endeavor with defined start-stop dates to achieve some sort of unique outcome and a series of outputs as a result. And so that's why, because it's as you've heard me say, projects are basically the fundamental unit of work in organizations, since, again, the pyramids, the aqueducts, these are how we construct these artifacts, how we run initiatives in organizations. As a result, our work gets organized into the structure of a project. Pull a team together, work, give a set of focused deliverables that we have in mind, and then you run through typically a defined budget and time frame. And so that's why projects have been so important and why they're still around after all these years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Despite, by the way, the infamous failures and classic mistakes.
Yeah, so can you put a number on what that cost of failure is? Project management?
We do talk about this at the beginning of each of my classes on project management. And as you know, for the last 22 years, we've now done 264 project retrospectives in a couple of hundred different types of organizations. So, through our deliverables, through our MS in the Management of IT program, we've been in a lot of different companies to see how they manage their projects, and we have come up with very similar metrics on failure to what the Standish Group has come up with for decades. They've looked at over 100,000 projects, and it's interesting that roughly 2 out of 3 projects fail on some significant point, whether that failure is an outright failure, they pull the plug on it, or a failure in terms of not of going over budget or over schedule. And so those what we call infamous failures are the ones that really get the most press. Those are the ones that I tend to focus on, are the ones that fail at the rate of over $100 million budgets. They're unfortunately, a lot of those in both the private and public sectors, but there are plenty of other failures to go around. Again, at smaller scales than that, and again, it's usually a failure on one of the key metrics that project managers are given to focus on.
Yeah, and what are those key metrics again that you would consider success or failure on?
Really, it's that trade-off triangle, the iron triangle of on time, on budget, meeting the requirements, Typically, depending on how you specify that, usually as originally defined in the project charter or in a contract, in the case of a third party endeavor. So that's that set of failures that really gets us focused on what are the root causes of those failures. And that's where there was some work done by Steve McConnell, formerly of Microsoft. He's runs a company called Constructs, and he wrote a best-selling book in the 90s called Rapid Development. In that book, he outlined 36 different classic mistakes that we picked up on and have added to. There's many more classic mistakes than 36, but we've used that as kind of the foundation for our analysis and our retrospectives over the years. And it's been interesting to see the most common of the classic mistakes are estimation and scheduling, or poor estimation and scheduling, problems with risk management, and then poor planning. Those three, and a close fourth is poor stakeholder management. So you kind of, as we study these project failures, we want to know why they failed and what are some of the root causes for those failures so that we can hopefully prevent the failures from happening at the same scale again or frequency.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I think a lot of those mistakes are very closely correlated with each other, right? If you have poor estimation, poor planning for a project, then almost by definition, you're also going to have poor stakeholder management, right? Because those are the things that they're really interested in knowing from you. When is this going to be done? How much is it going to cost?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Exactly.
Something that I wanted to say is that it's always been amazing for me to when we see the number. I mean, we are talking about trillions in losses per year in IT project failure. So, it blows my mind, because this is covering not only private sector, also the public sector. And for me, it's particularly a sensitive topic today, particularly because I don't know if you've known this, but we have almost 3 weeks or a month in Costa Rica that the tax system is down. It's basically for a hacking event, but still, I mean, it is an IT problem. It is an IT problem, and by itself, it's a project. How do we get out of this situation? And they still don't have even a clue how to get out of it. is the general public, the voters, aware of the amount of money the governments are losing in bad project management in IT, and the horrific amount of money they are losing? So it's just mind blowing that people is not that aware of this situation. I mean, the common folk. I mean, right. The no IT people. I mean, is mind blowing.
Who may or may not be paying their taxes that go into that that loss. And there's a back of a napkin kind of calculation that I like to cite in class about how it adds up. You mentioned trillions, and really, the most current estimate on that is close to $8 trillion per year when it comes to the amount spent on IT projects that have gone wrong. Again, those failures. And you can do that. You mentioned Costa Rica. You could take Costa Rica's GDP and multiply it through, to go through this back of the napkin calculation to come out with the amount of failure for that country. It's about $2 trillion in the United States each year. Again, estimated. There's a good article that came out in the Harvard Business Review in November of last year that talks about how the project economy has arrived. And as I indicated a few minutes ago, I think we've been in a project-centric world for thousands of years. But as you kind of look forward, this is an article written by the former chair of the Project Management Institute. So as he's really been focused himself on IT and projects in general. And he estimates that the value of project-oriented economic activity will reach $20 trillion by 2027. But as you just pointed out, David, you know, we're also talking about a huge set of a huge dollar amount when it comes to lost money, whether it comes in opportunity costs or straight costs from projects.
Yeah, it's more than the money that was invested in that product. It's the opportunity cost of what that project was trying to achieve, right? You know, one of the healthcare.gov was one of the infamous failures here in the U.S. Kind of a similar scenario to what you described, David, in terms of just a huge impact on the public as a whole. People who have no concept of what IT project management is, or what the classic mistakes are, but are certainly impacted by that. Are there any other kind of I'll say favorite infamous failures that you have, Ryan?
Oh, one that I always like to talk about is the FBI's Trilogy project. And what happened in that was right around the time that 9/11 occurred. And the interesting part of that story is that the mission of the organization changed dramatically when 9/11 happened. And this is the FBI, who, you know, used to be, you know, really known as a law enforcement organization. And when 9/11 happened, they became much more of a terrorism fighting organization. And when that mission, fundamental mission, changed, all of their projects throughout the organization should have changed along with it and adapted with that change in mission, but they didn't. And as a result, all these projects that were, you know, in flight went to fruition, only to find out that their, you know, outputs that they were organized to create were no longer relevant. So as a result, I think it was $170 million got written off on that particular project, a section of it. And that's one that, you know, is a real, you know, lesson to be learned, that when an organization's strategy changes, and today it changes faster than ever with the changing environment, you must, you know, then adapt. Your projects have to adapt along with that. And unfortunately, we're not really set up to do that in most organizations.
Yeah, it's a really interesting and powerful point, right? I think, if, you know, for our listeners being engineering managers, generally speaking, they're probably being given some sort of directive from executive management on a project that they need to accomplish and a budget and a time frame around that. But what you're highlighting there with the FBI example is how important it is for them to also know the strategy behind that, the reason that they're doing it, right? That full project charter, you know, as you discussed about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, that means once a year, planning and budgeting cycles that to really come up with what are the prioritized portfolio of projects and programs for the year. And, you know, became the most innovative companies are ones that try to get that planning cycle down to a quarterly basis. A few, like Capital One, really tried to get it down to a matter of weeks. And they then found that they had trouble with the actual delivery cycles and, you know, how the organization of teams work and the communication cycles, you know, to try to get the any changes that they might want to make recalibrated throughout the organization and through the budget that had already been set.
So that's great.
Yeah,
I didn't know that about Capital One. That's fantastic, because that gives them the opportunity. I mean, if they have the chance to review the planning every few weeks, that gives them the chance to adapt. There's no way for you to adapt if you don't have feedback enough to, relevant feedback to make a change fast enough. So it seems to me what you're saying is that Capital One is doing fast delivery. So they try to deliver fast, ship fast. their projects. I mean, some to get the deliverables as fast as possible.
That's right. And they also have, like a lot of progressive companies have done, is even push further than that into a complete change in mindset from project to product. And that has really kind of broken the cycle of the annual planning and budgeting cycle. So Capital One is a great example of one of the companies that have really started to figure out that, you know, just trying to do the planning cycles on a couple of week basis for projects wasn't enough. That was really more of a general mindset that was required.
I love that. And Professor Nelson, something I wanted to point out is in my experience being a person in charge of building a product time and time again, the biggest, I mean, as you mentioned, is a bad risk assessment policy is one of the reasons of project failure, and then poor planning. I'm going to say that when I was doing product creation process, that the thing that I pay attention to most is every single integration point that I have to take into account. So, I mean, there is no product that lives independent of anything else. I mean, always every single product that we're going to build, every single project, software project, IT project that we do needs to be integrated with something else that already exists. It could be, I mean, services in the cloud, he could be all system, legacy systems, whatever. So they always have to be integrated with something else. And for me, those are the most important sources of uncertainty, always. Those are always the points that will always derail the estimations. And you have to go back to the estimation that you had before, because you never know. I mean, that how you're going to connect things, all the assumptions you had about how the system works, the system that you have to integrate to, how that works, what are the parameters that you have to take into account, the workload, the frequency, that kind of thing. I mean, those assumptions are always wrong. Always, 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 always. So that's, for me, I mean, the way that I could manage to get success is to take that as a first class citizen if my concerns about, I mean, dealing with, I mean, it is not that you I mean, that it is less cause of uncertainty to build software by itself. I mean, the requirement, just writing down code, that is easy, I think. I mean, compared with now you have to integrate that with the real world. that causes just problems always, every single time. Have you had any experience? I mean, any thoughts on that, Professor Nelson?
Yes, I mean, as you point out, I mean, the projects are integrated with everything else in the internal environment, but the external environment is constantly changing, and as that happens, you simply have to adapt everything else that you're doing. And so, I think one thing that I've noticed, I'm fortunate enough to be able to lead class trips from the University of Virginia to Silicon Valley and visit some of the digital native companies, you know, like Facebook and Google, LinkedIn, on and on. And each of these companies have figured out that they needed to change their entire approach to how work gets done in those organizations. So, you know, how to become much more nimble. You know, how can they be adaptive, you know, to their environment, whether it's external or internal, in all the interconnections. And so, you know, that change in mindset really, you know, became much more of a focus on outcomes over outputs. You know, if we're talking about this iron triangle, you know, we've got these these budgets and defined schedules, but we also have these defined requirements from the very start. And as things change in your environment, you want to be able to change, you know, much more rapidly than what even Capital One was able to do with their change in project approach. And that's what these organizations, whether it's, you know, through changes in delivery cycles through DevOps or on the actual construction of the products through a different approach. You know, how do you empower? A great book by Marty Kagan called Empowered. Another great book called Inspired that he wrote where he's 10 years ago, where, you know, he really was kind of capturing what we have seen on these digital safaris. And that is this new mindset of and practice of empowering product managers with outcomes in mind. This is the you know, sometimes you hear OKRs, objectives and key results. Given those OKRs the start of a cycle, and then empowering them to do what's necessary with their team to deliver on that goal, that outcome. And that's what they have as kind of their North Star. Then everything else that they are empowered to do is up to them. You know, they will, when they need to reach out and figure out who else in the organization, in or outside the organization, they need to integrate with, they know to do that. Now, that is up to them to do that, not only what has been predefined in a requirements specification is in the project world. So that's something that I've certainly seen, you know, a movement that started over a decade ago in the West Coast in Silicon Valley, that's now, you know, making its way across the country and in various places around the world as well.
So it's when we talk about all these different infamous failures, and you know, we gave several examples of very public sector failures in our conversation already. It's important to note that, you know, those statistics from the Standish Group and that you've seen in your own research, Ryan, is 2/3 of projects failing no matter who's working on it, right? So for our listeners, probably 2/3 of your projects have failed too, even though they weren't on the nightly news, even though they weren't in the public sector, right? So this is tremendously important at any level of work. I mean, how do we kind of change the thinking in this? And it's been over 30 years now that you've been leading a Center for Management of Innovative Technology, I believe, right? Congratulations on that. So you've seen a lot of changes in the industry. What are some of those most monumental changes that you've seen? What are the changes that we still need to make in our thinking about projects or the way that we work?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I've been preaching for over 20 years is the importance of doing retrospectives and, you know, these analysis of what went right and wrong on a project. And, you know, there have been books written about how to do project retrospectives, you know, at a very large scale and then at a smaller scale, agile retrospectives. And thanks to the agile movement, retrospectives have become a lot more common than they had been. And there was a study done by Gartner that said only 13% of organizations do project retrospectives. That was over 10 years ago. Today, I would like to believe that most organizations do retrospectives, but in an agile basis at the end of every sprint, even at the end of a daily stand-up at the end of the day is a form of retrospective. And so one of the key things that I have always preached is really learning from the past to hopefully prevent those kind of classic mistakes or things that have to happen, on a day-to-day basis from happening going forward, and really figuring out, you know, what the root causes are, you know, not just listing those classic mistakes, but zeroing in to figure out what are the root causes in our specific organization that we need to attend to become a, you know, a more effective, productive organization. So that's one.
Absolutely. Yeah. What are some of the best practices to resolve particular classic mistakes. And you don't need to go through all 36 of them, plus 36 plus of them, obviously. But, you know, one or two, what kind of your favorite classic mistakes, and how, what are the best practices that we can use these days to help minimize the risk of that mistake?
Sure. And I always like to talk about, you know, at least conceptually in your mind, you should kind of have this matrix of best practices that align with certain classic mistakes, and then customize that for your organization. So, you know, really, you know, agile development is one best practice that addresses the top three classic mistakes, the most common ones that we see occurring at over half the projects that we've studied. You know, poor estimation and scheduling, poor planning, risk management issues. Agile helps address the issue, fundamental issues with all three of those classic mistakes. So that's one. You know, DevOps on delivery, you know, that's another. It kind of helps break, you know, certain cycles and behavior patterns, that occur. Change management, you know, from the soft side of things, you know, that, proper change management skills really address a lot of the problems in adoption of whatever, you know, product we end up creating. So, you know, I really encourage organizations to, you know, capture what are the most common issues that they tend to face, and then also try to figure out what are the best practices that align with those specific mistakes that, you know, show up, occur most frequently in their organizations, and start, you know, actively, proactively addressing those so that they, you know, are a better, you know, higher achieving organization going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think in terms of, you know, how Agile addresses these, one of the things I've always found most interesting about this idea and this reality of over two thirds projects failing, you know, the as you said, the standard for that to call a project a failure is that it missed its timeline, its budget, or its scope that was set out for that project in the project charter or whatever at the beginning. And Agile takes a very different approach of that. And the way I often talk to people at, if I'm talking to somebody about a new project and they're saying, you know, I need you to do this in this budget by this timeline, I always say, well, which one of those three legs of the stool is most important to you? Which is the one that you don't, under any condition, you don't want me to change? You know, you have an absolutely fixed budget that under no condition I can exceed, or this, you know, I can give you less features, but it has to be done by this date. You know, pick one, because you can't have all three of those in most cases, right? And I think Agile methodologies enable that sort of conversation and give you a way to manage towards that, that doesn't take the assumption that all three of those are going to be fixed up front. And just that one simple change in mindset is, I think, fundamental to being on the 30% of projects that succeed. Because if you acknowledge up front that, you know, maybe our scope is flexible as long as we're hitting the timeline and budget, then it's not necessarily a failure, right? You know, it's really a change in perspective that changes it from a failure to a success in the way that you work together and set those expectations.
Yeah, it's really amazing to me that we've been practicing under that definition of success for so long. And as you pointed out, that, and this was something I observed when my students would come back to present the retrospective findings in class, that they'd say, all right, you know, technically this project was a failure because it was over budget, or, you know, didn't meet the requirements as originally specified. Yet when we ask our clients, you know, the people in the organization of for the project we're studying, if it was the project was a success or a failure, they still are saying it was a success. So they were very
right, a successful failure, right?
Yeah. So that led to the phrase a successful failure, because it was a success in their view, because the outputs were the product that was produced was being used and was adding value to the organization. So even though it was late, It was over budget. It was still, at the end, considered to be a success. A failure on the process side, a success on the outcome side. So right. That that's something that tend to stick. And I mentioned this article that was in HBR recently, and in that article tends to point to that same concept, this author gets into the same, thought that you really need to be much more outcome driven. And one thing I like that he and a few other authors have also come up with is something called the Project Canvas. It's if you've heard of the business model canvas, a very lean way to capture a business model of a firm. Well, it's the same concept applied to projects. So in this article, he proposes a canvas for capturing and very importantly, what is the goal right off the bat, the goal of this project. And so, it's the right approach. It still encounters the same problems that we've been talking about in terms of that are inherent to a project mindset, but it gets at it addresses one of the major ones, and that's put front and center the outcome first, and then try to push in the background some of the other key metrics of budget, scope, and time.
Yeah. I mean, whether you're using a project canvas or a charter or like Amazon has their two pagers, their six pager documents, whatever the sort of framework is that you're using, I think the most important thing about all of those is establishing that common understanding in the team at the beginning of the project of, what's the strategy behind this? Why are we doing this? How will we judge success, right? Because back to that iron triangle of time and scope and budget, if the team is not clear on which one or more of those three items is the flexible one and which one or more is the inflexible one, then they're going to make poor choices that ultimately determine whether it's a successful failure or a failed failure, right? Or hopefully a total success. But they have to understand that, these are because this is the outcome we want, because this is the strategy behind this, it's most important that we do this. It's most important that we achieve this part of that iron triangle. And yeah, I think all of these frameworks are great for doing that. And that's perhaps the most crucial thing, is making sure that there's that common understanding across the engineering leadership, the business leadership, executive leadership, down to the individual developers and testers building that product.
That's right. And, the good news is that, more and more organizations are starting to figure this out. More and more universities are figuring out how to teach some of this change in mindset. For the last half dozen years, we not only have a project management class, but a product management class to really kind of cover the gambit of work activities out there. There's a book, we got our lead off keynote speaker on Friday's program is Peter High, who last year published a book called Getting to Nimble. And in that book, he features a number of organizations that happen to be, in close proximity to the University of Virginia. Capital One, we've already talked about, CarMax, and the Washington Post. And so we have, following his keynote, we have a panel of representatives, chief information officers, and executive vice presidents from those three organizations. They're going to talk about more or less some of the same things we've been talking about. What have they changed about their transformed within their organizations to allow them to be much more nimble, faster to adapt? So that they are constantly reevaluating those outcomes and the ROI that they need out of the product they're building, and all the other things associated with that from a cultural and structural perspective as well.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned those things, most of our audience is concerned about growing, scaling. And so, in your opinion, what are it seems to me, before asking your opinion, it seems to me that the same principles you are mentioning about the definition of the project should consider also the consequences of bringing in people into the organization to execute the project. I mean, all the cultural changes, the onboarding processes, how to gradually add people so it makes sense. Maybe not all at once, all the people that we need, because it's impossible to deal with all of that chaos, that kind of thing. I mean, it's do you have any kind of advice for that? I mean, for growing, for scaling up people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've written case studies on CarMax and the Washington Post to look back and, again, more or less an organizational retrospective of their digital transformation that each of them has been the journey they've been going through for roughly about 10 years each. And what each of them did in terms of scaling is start small, start with one product team that is operating under the new practices of and mindset that we've been talking about, and then see how successful it is and why they end up being successful, and then to try to start scaling by adding a second and then a third product-oriented team while project-oriented teams are still operating in those organizations. And then eventually, CarMax, by the time I finished writing my case study on them a few years ago, they had approximately 30 product teams. Well, they now have well over 50 product teams. The interesting thing about scalability is that you then need to pull all of those 50 plus product teams together periodically to make sure that you're all heading as an organization in the same direction. You don't want product teams, heading in with substantively different strategies in mind. So there still needs to be some form of organizing mechanism to communicate organizational strategy to the product teams and then to feed that back up. And so CarMax has open houses every couple of weeks that are fascinating to watch, because each product team will present what they've been doing for the last 2 weeks and what they plan to be doing over the next 2 weeks. They talk about any of the major challenges that they're having. And in that meeting, the CIO of the organization, the COO of the organization, the CMO, marketing officer of the organization, are present. And so they're engaged in this communication of strategy as well as delivery in an ongoing basis. So scalability, is an important thing that you have to begin to address very quickly. I mean, it's the same with the practices behind Agile and Scaled Agile. There are other new practices that value streams in organizations, and then how can you convert? I think you had a guest on to talk about the conversion from a project or program management office to an agile value management organization. That's what needs to happen in organizations. They need to actually start reconstructing themselves to adopt this new mindset and set of practices as well that are very, very, very different. And that's the key challenge, not like flipping a switch. If you think back to what happened between Waterfall and Agile, whether you're Capital One or another organization, you don't do it overnight. It's more like a decade long process of making that change. That change management that's required to make that shift in mindset, the culture, the organizational structure, how are organizations, as you brought it up, David, onboarded and trained to work in that new environment. because it's very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan, you already brought up one really important concept, and yeah, we had a prior guest on the podcast, Sanjeev Augustine from LifeSpeed, talking about moving from a project management office concept to a value management office, and so that idea of moving from managing projects to managing value streams, certainly something agile scaling methods talk about. As we start to wrap up here, I want to ask one more question for you, a little controversial here. And see what you think. You know, there was an interesting article in Harvard Business Review recently by the title, "Do We Still Need Teams?" And making the case that, you know, with all of the disruption that we've seen due to the pandemic in remote working, hybrid models and all of that, they made the statement here that, now, I'll read a little bit from it here. The level of variance that hybrid teamwork creates has never been seen before in organizational life and is bringing many managers to the breaking point," end quote. And they say that later in the article, quote, that true teams have a shared mindset, a compelling joint mission, defined roles, stable membership, high interdependence, and clear norms, end quote, which I would agree with that. But their point, I guess, is that in this new form of work, that means we can't really have teams anymore. They don't say it that assertively, to be fair. It's more and more difficult. And so the question is, do we still need teams, and do we still need projects in our mindset at all, or are we moving towards something entirely different?
Yeah, I'm a huge proponent of teams, high functioning teams, of course. We have a number of classes at UVA and the McIntyre School of Commerce in particular that are focused on how to manage teams, how to lead teams. We have organizational behavior faculty that are very adept at teaching. Not just the knowledge and the concepts around teams, but the actual practice of how to create, the forming, norming, storming approach to team building and effective teams. And so that's also how I think the best work gets done. I mean, and when I think about diversity and innovation, it doesn't happen when you're working by yourself in your home office. It's really working with, and ideally, in many cases, and Marty Kagan is a big proponent of this as well, co-located teams. Mm-hmm. So, that's been the big challenge over the last couple of years, is how to have, highly functional teams that cannot be co-located. We actually did a case study 2 years ago on Willow Tree, which is a digital products firm that is located headquartered in Charlottesville, but has multiple offices around the U.S. And they just finished 2 years ago, as the pandemic was starting, a brand new building headquarters facility that they couldn't move in to. So
it was a beautiful empty building.
Yeah, beautiful empty building. In a nice part of Charlottesville, right on the river, and so that was how that case was written up. What do they do? I mean, how can they try to replicate some of the practices that their highly effective teams? And by the way, this was a condition. They have these conditions that when they sign a contract with one of their clients, they have the set of conditions that they expect, and one of them is co-location of the teams. And that's really a practice, a best practice for building products, and they couldn't do it. So it's been a huge challenge for them to work with. There are a lot of tools, as you know, that they can use to help address that, whether they're whiteboarding, collaborative whiteboarding, tools or other forms for communication and so forth, video and so forth. But we're now going to go back in just a couple of weeks to do a B case on Willow Tree to find out, what has happened over the 2 years. What are, realizing that this has been a major challenge, what have you learned about those? So I'm still, I understand the point about, you know, teams are hard, you know, it's for a lot of reasons, you know, the, you know, communication requirements, you know, the keeping everybody on the same page, you know, how do you get the right, you know, blend of skills and organization. But really, you know, I don't see, you know, other than, you know, trying to become very task, you know, very specifically task oriented to say, all right, you're going to do this task. And then that sounds like waterfall to me, right? We're going to throw it over the wall.
Exactly.
You know, here's what we need, throw it over the wall and then expect to, we're going to get back what we threw, what we expected. And that just doesn't operate that well. Now there are certain, probably certain, you know, certain initiatives that might work fine in that kind of a model. But I think generally speaking, in our world, again, the digital products world, I think, you know, teams are still the way to go.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, we don't want to go back to a throwing tasks over the wall, because then we're going to be repeating a lot of the same classic mistakes that you talked about. You can't give someone a 2-day task and expect them to deliver it with the same common shared understanding that a team has of why are we doing this work? What are the goals for it? What are the standards of the work that we're doing? You know, all of those things that a team can develop that shared understanding. I do think it's critical. And I think that, you know, personally speaking, I think it's just, this has been a shock for a lot of companies going to remote. And so they're feeling some extreme, difficulty in that change, right? But, you know, David and I have been working with remote teams for over a decade now. Stick with it. You could still have a great team dynamic and be remote and be distributed. And I think companies are starting to figure that out. And, you know, the last thing we want to do is swing the pendulum back in another direction and start to repeat these classic mistakes again. We've had enough infamous failures. It'd be nice to swap that statistic and start to see 70% of projects failing instead of only 70% of projects succeeding instead of 70% of projects failing. So
here, here, that's right. Very good. in this conversation.
Well, Ryan, in yet another example of poor estimation abilities, which I regularly demonstrate personally in terms of time estimation of talking, we've gone over the amount of time I told you we were going to talk, but I think the value delivered, this has been still a very successful failure in time management on my part, because this has been a great conversation with you. I really appreciate it. I want to just give you a quick shout out to you and to University of Virginia, McIntyre School of Commerce, the MSN Management of IT program there that I graduated from, and how we met. I think it over 10 years ago since I joined that, but it was really real turning point in my career personally. I had been an engineer prior to that. Most of the project management skills that I had were self-learned up to that point, and it was tremendously both affirming of what I knew and was doing well as educational about the many things I was not doing well. And that program really gave me personally the confidence to then go out and become an agile coach and trainer after that, which then led into this beautiful decade plus of work with David and building this international company. And, you know, it's just been a wonderful journey in McIntyre, and you were a part of that. So I want to thank you publicly for that. And anybody looking for a program, it's a great one to join. You don't have to be in Charlottesville to do it. A lot of great benefits from that. You mentioned, you know, this Friday after we're recording, it'll be a knowledge continuum that you're leading. So even over a decade later, alumni still join at these events and we continue to learn from each other. So thank you very much for that, Ryan, for everything you and Stefano and Barb and all of the wonderful professors that I had in that program, for all that you did for me and continue to do for others.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Aaron, this has been a great conversation with you and David. David, as you know, Aaron's what we call a definition of a successful success.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was about to ask that. I mean,
he wasn't sure, so I appreciate your vouchership support.
I wasn't sure. Yeah, just kidding.
One thing that we love the most about our program is the ability to learn from our students, and that's certainly been the case with Aaron. So,
That's so nice. Yeah, I mean, I can attest that as well. I mean, I learn from him a lot every day. So yeah, it's. I can say he's a successful success. That's like,
should have a t-shirt.
I feel like that. Yeah. I am a successful success. Yeah.
I appreciate the kind words from both of you. I'm going to get that tattooed right after this, before either of you change your mind. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Ryan, for your time.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit ScalingTechPod.com.